I'd been starting. It was a project of mine to replace the tournament with something which might furnish an escape for the extra steam of the chivalry, keep those bucks entertained and out of mischief, and at the same time preserved the best thing in them, which was their hardy spirit of emulation. I had had a choice band of them in private training for some time, and the date was now arriving for their first public effort. This experiment was baseball. In order to give the thing vogue from the start and place it out of the reach of criticism, I chose my nines by rank, not capacity. There wasn't a knight in either team who wasn't a sceptered sovereign. As for material of this sort, there was a glut of it always around Arthur. You couldn't throw a brick in any direction and not cripple a king. Of course, I couldn't get these people to leave off their armor. They wouldn't do that when they bathed. They consented to differentiate the armor so that a body could tell one team from the other, but that was the most they would do. So one of the teams wore chainmail ulsters, and the other wore plate armor made of my new Bessemer steel. Their practice in the field was the most fantastic thing I ever saw. Being ball-proof, they never skipped out of the way, but stood still and took the result. When a Bessemer was at the bat and a ball hit him, it would bound 150 yards sometimes. And when a man was running and threw himself on his stomach to slide to his base, it was like an ironclad coming into port. At first I appointed men of no rank to act as umpires, but I had to discontinue that. These people were no easier to please than other nines. The umpire's first decision was usually his last. They broke him in two with a bat, and his friends toted him home on a shutter. When it was noticed that no umpire ever survived a game, umpiring got to be unpopular. So I was obliged to appoint somebody whose rank and lofty position under the government would protect him. Here are the names of the nines. Bessemers. King Arthur. King Lot of Lothian. King of Northgalis. King Marsil. King of Little Britain. King Labor. King Pelham of Listengaze. King Bagdemagus. King Tulem La Fent. Ulsters. Emperor Lucius. King Logris. King Marhalt of Ireland. King Morganor, King Mark of Cornwall, King Nentres of Garlet, King Meliadus of Lyonis, King of the Lake, the Soden of Syria. Umpire, Clarence. The first public game would certainly draw 50,000 people, and for solid fun would be worth going around the world to see. Everything would be favorable. It was balmy and beautiful spring weather now, and nature was all tailored out in her new clothes. Chapter 41. The Interdict. However, my attention was suddenly snatched from such matters. Our child began to lose ground again, and we had to go sitting up with her. Her case became so serious. We couldn't bear to allow anybody to help in this service, so we two stood watch and watch, day in and day out. Ah, Sandy, what a right heart she had. How simple and genuine and good she was. She was a flawless wife and mother, and yet I had married her for no other particular reasons, except that by the customs of chivalry she was my property until some knight should win her from me in the field. She had hunted Britain over for me, had found me at the hanging bout outside of London, and had straightway resumed her old place at my side, in the placidest way and as of right. I was a New Englander, and in my opinion this sort of partnership would compromise her sooner or later. She couldn't see how, but I cut argument short, and we had a wedding. Now, I didn't know I was drawing a prize, yet that was what I did draw. Within the 12 months, I became her worshipper, and ours was the dearest and perfectest comradeship that ever was. People talk about beautiful friendships between two persons of the same sex. What is the best of that sort as compared with the friendship of man and wife, where the best impulses and highest ideals of both are the same? There is no place for comparison between the two friendships. The one is earthly, the other divine. In my dreams, along at first, I still wandered 13 centuries away, and my unsatisfied spirit went calling and harking all up and down the unreplying vacancies of a vanished world. Many a time Sandy heard that imploring cry come from my lips in my sleep. With a grand magnanimity, she saddled that cry of mine upon our child, conceiving it to be the name of some lost darling of mine. It touched me to tears, and it also nearly knocked me off my feet, too, when she smiled up in my face for an earned reward and played her quaint and pretty surprise upon me. "The name of one who was dear to thee is here preserved, here made holy, and the music of it will abide alway in our ears. Now thou'lt kiss me as knowing the name I have given the child." But I didn't know it all the same. I hadn't an idea in the world, but it would have been cruel to confess it and spoil her pretty game. So I never let on, but said, "Yes, I know, sweetheart, how dear and good it is of you, too. But I want to hear these lips of yours, which are also mine, utter it first. Then its music will be perfect." Pleased to the marrow, she murmured, "Hello, Central." I didn't laugh. I am always thankful for that. But the strain ruptured every cartilage in me, and for weeks afterward I could hear my bones clack when I walked. She never found out her mistake. The first time she heard that form of salute used at the telephone, she was surprised and not pleased. But I told her I had given order for it, that henceforth and forever the telephone must always be invoked with that reverent formality, in perpetual honor and remembrance of my lost friend and her small namesake. This was not true, but it answered. Well, during 2.5 weeks we watched by the crib, and in our deep solicitude we were unconscious of any world outside of that sick room. Then our reward came. The center of the universe turned the corner and began to mend. Grateful? It isn't the term. There isn't any term for it. You know that yourself, if you've watched your child through the valley of the shadow and seen it come back to life and sweep night out of the earth with one all-illuminating smile that you could cover with your hand. Why, we were back in this world in one instant. Then we looked the same startled thought into each other's eyes at the same moment. More than 2 weeks gone, and that ship not back yet. In another minute I appeared in the presence of my train. They had been steeped in troubled bodings all this time. Their faces showed it. I called an escort, and we galloped 5 miles to a hilltop overlooking the sea. Where was my great commerce that so lately had made these glistening expanses populous and beautiful with its white-winged flocks? Vanished every one. Not a sail from verge to verge, not a smoke bank, just a dead and empty solitude in place of all that brisk and breezy life. I went swiftly back, saying not a word to anybody. I told Sandy this ghastly news. We could imagine no explanation that would begin to explain. Had there been an invasion, an earthquake, a pestilence? Had the nation been swept out of existence? But guessing was profitless. I must go, at once. I borrowed the King's Navy, a ship no bigger than a steam launch, and was soon ready. The parting. Ah, yes, that was hard. As I was devouring the child with last kisses, it brisked up and jabbered out its vocabulary. The first time in more than 2 weeks, and it made fools of us for joy. The darling mispronunciations of childhood. Dear me, there is no music that can touch it. And how one grieves when it wastes away and dissolves into correctness, knowing it will never visit his bereaved ear again. Well, how good it was to be able to carry that gracious memory away with me. I approached England the next morning with the wide highway of salt water all to myself. There were ships in the harbor at Dover, but they were naked as to sails, and there was no sign of life about them. It was Sunday, yet at Canterbury the streets were empty. Strangest of all, there was not even a priest in sight, and no stroke of a bell fell upon my ear. The mournfulness of death was everywhere. I couldn't understand it. At last, in the further edge of that town, I saw a small funeral procession. Just a family and a few friends following a coffin. No priest. A funeral without bell, book, or candle. There was a church there close at hand, but they passed it by weeping and did not enter it. I glanced up at the belfry, and there hung the bell, shrouded in black, and its tongue tied back. Now I knew. Now I understood the stupendous calamity that had overtaken England. Invasion? Invasion is a triviality to it. It was the interdict. I asked no questions. I didn't need to ask any. The church had struck. The thing for me to do was to get into a disguise and go warily. One of my servants gave me a suit of clothes, and when we were safe beyond the town, I put them on. And from that time, I traveled alone. I could not risk the embarrassment of company. A miserable journey. A desolate silence everywhere. Even in London itself. Traffic had ceased. Men did not talk or laugh or go in groups or even in couples. They moved aimlessly about, each man by himself, with his head down and woe and terror at his heart. The tower showed recent war scars. Verily, much had been happening. Of course, I meant to take the train for Camelot. Train? Why, the station was as vacant as a cavern. I moved on. The journey to Camelot was a repetition of what I had already seen. The Monday and the Tuesday differed in no way from the Sunday. I arrived far in the night. From being the best electric-lighted town in the kingdom and the most like a recumbent sun of anything you ever saw, it was become simply a blot. A blot upon darkness. That is to say, it was darker and solider than the rest of the darkness, and so you could see it a little better. It made me feel as if maybe it was symbolical, a sort of sign that the church was going to keep the upper hand now and snuff out all my beautiful civilization just like that. I found no life stirring in the somber streets. I groped my way with a heavy heart. The vast castle loomed black upon the hilltop, not a spark visible about it. The drawbridge was down, the great gate stood wide. I entered without challenge, my own heels making the only sound I heard. And it was sepulchral enough in those huge vacant courts. Chapter 42. War. I found Clarence alone in his quarters, drowned in melancholy, and in place of the electric light, he had reinstituted the ancient rag lamp, and sat there in a grisly twilight with all curtains drawn tight. He sprang up and rushed for me, eagerly saying, "Oh, it's worth a billion milrays to look upon a live person again." He knew me as easily as if I hadn't been disguised at all, which frightened me. One may easily believe that. Quick now, tell me the meaning of this fearful disaster, I said. How did it come about? Well, if there hadn't been any Queen Guinevere, it wouldn't have come so early, but it would have come anyway. It would have come on your own account, by and by. By luck, it happened to come on the Queen's. And Sir Lancelot's? Just so. Give me the details. I reckon you will grant that during some years there has been only one pair of eyes in these kingdoms that has not been looking steadily askance at the Queen and Sir Lancelot. Yes, King Arthur's. And only one heart that was without suspicion. Yes, the King's. A heart that isn't capable of thinking evil of a friend. Well, the King might have gone on, still happy and unsuspecting, to the end of his days, but for one of your modern improvements, the stock board. When you left, 3 miles of the London, Canterbury, and Dover were ready for the rails, and also ready and ripe for manipulation in the stock market. It was wildcat, and everybody knew it. The stock was for sale at a giveaway. What does Sir Lancelot do but— Yes, I know, he quietly picked up nearly all of it for a song. Then he bought about twice as much more, deliverable upon call, and he was about to call when I left. Very well, he did call. The boys couldn't deliver. Oh, he had them, and he just settled his grip and squeezed them. They were laughing in their sleeves over their smartness in selling stock to him at 15 and 16 and along there that wasn't worth 10. Well, when they had laughed long enough on that side of their mouths, they rested up that side by shifting the laugh to the other side. That was when they compromised with the Invincible at 283. Good land! He skinned them alive, and they deserved it. Anyway, the whole kingdom rejoiced. Well, among the flayed were Sir Agravaine and Sir Mordred, nephews to the king. End of the first act. Act second, scene first, an apartment in Carlisle Castle, where the court had gone for a few days hunting. Persons present, the whole tribe of the king's nephews. Mordred and Agravaine proposed to call the guileless Arthur's attention to Guinevere and Sir Lancelot. Sir Gawain, Sir Gareth, and Sir Gaheris will have nothing to do with it. A dispute ensues, with loud talk. In the midst of it enter the king. Mordred and Agravaine spring the devastating tale upon him. Tableau. A trap is laid for Lancelot, by the king's command, and Sir Lancelot walks into it. He made it sufficiently uncomfortable for the ambushed witnesses, to wit Mordred, Agravaine, and 12 knights of lesser rank, for he killed every one of them but Mordred. But of course that couldn't straighten matters between Lancelot and the king, and didn't.
Oh dear. Only one thing could result, I see that. War, and the knights of the realm divided into a king's party and a Sir Lancelot's party.
Yes, that was the way of it. The king sent the queen to the stake, proposing to purify her with fire. Lancelot and his knights rescued her, and in doing it slew certain good old friends of yours and mine— In fact, some of the best we ever had. To wit, Sir Belius le Orgulus, Sir Segwarides, Sir Griflet le Fils de Dieu, Sir Brandiles, Sir Aglovale.
Oh, you tear out my heartstrings.
Wait, I'm not done yet. Sir Tor, Sir Goter, Sir Gillimer, the very best man in my subordinate 9. What a handy right fielder he was. Sir Reynolds' 3 brothers, Sir Damas, Sir Priamus, Sir Kay the Stranger, my peerless shortstop. I've seen him catch a daisy cutter in his teeth. Come, I can't stand this. Sir Dryant, Sir Lambigus, Sir Hermandy, Sir Pertilope, Sir Perimenes, and whom do you think?
Rush, go on.
Sir Gaheris and Sir Gareth both.
Oh, incredible. Their love for Lancelot was indestructible.
Well, it was an accident. They were simply onlookers. They were unarmed and were merely there to witness the queen's punishment. Sir Lancelot smote down whoever came in the way of his blind fury, and he killed these without noticing who they were. Here is an instantaneous photograph one of our boys got of the battle. It's for sale on every newsstand. There, the figures nearest the queen are Sir Lancelot with his sword up and Sir Gareth gasping his latest breath. You can catch the agony in the queen's face through the curling smoke. It's a rattling battle picture.
Indeed, it is. We must take good care of it. Its historical value is incalculable. Go on.
Well, the rest of the tale is just war, pure and simple. Lancelot retreated to his town and castle of Joyous Gard, and gathered there a great following of knights. The king, with a great host, went there, and there was desperate fighting during several days, and as a result, all the plain around was paved with corpses and cast iron. Then the church patched up a peace between Arthur and Lancelot and the queen and everybody but Sir Gawain. He was bitter about the slaying of his brothers, Gareth and Gaheris, and would not be appeased. He notified Lancelot to get him thence and make swift preparation and look to be soon attacked. So Lancelot sailed to his duchy of Guienne with his following, and Gawain soon followed him with an army, and he beguiled Arthur to go with him. Arthur left the kingdom in Sir Mordred's hands until you should return.
A king's customary wisdom.
Yes. Sir Mordred set himself at once to work to make his kingship permanent. He was going to marry Guinevere as a first move, but she fled and shut herself up in the Tower of London. Mordred attacked. The Bishop of Canterbury dropped down on him with the interdict. The king returned. Mordred fought him at Dover, at Canterbury, and again at Barham Down. Then there was talk of peace and a composition. Terms: Mordred to have Cornwall and Kent during Arthur's life, and the whole kingdom afterward.
Well, upon my word, my dream of a republic to be a dream and so remain.
Yes, the two armies lay near Salisbury.
Gawain's head, is at Dover Castle. He fell in the fight there.
Gawain appeared to Arthur in a dream, at least his ghost did, and warned him to refrain from conflict for a month, let the delay cost what it might. But battle was precipitated by an accident. Arthur had given order that if a sword was raised during the consultation over the proposed treaty with Mordred, sound the trumpet and fall on, for he had no confidence in Mordred. Mordred had given a similar order to his people. Well, by and by, an adder bit a knight's heel. The knight forgot all about the order and made a slash at the adder with his sword. Inside of half a minute, those two prodigious hosts came together with a crash. They butchered away all day. Then the king... However, we have started something fresh since you left, our paper has.
No, what is that?
War correspondence.
Why, that's good.
Yes, the paper was booming right along, for the interdict made no impression, got no grip, while the war lasted. I had war correspondence with both armies. I will finish that battle by reading you what one of the boys says.
Then the king looked about him, and then was he ware of all of his host, and of all his good knights were left no more on live but two knights. That was Sir Lucan de Butler and his brother Sir Bedivere, and they were full sore wounded.
Jesu mercy, said the king, where are all my noble knights becomin'?
Alas, that ever I should see this doleful day. For now, said Arthur, I am come to mine end. But would to God that I wist where were that traitor Sir Mordred, that hath caused all this mischief. Then was King Arthur where Sir Mordred leaned upon his sword among a great heap of dead men. Now give me my spear, said Arthur unto Sir Lucan, for yonder I have espied the traitor that all this woe hath wrought. Sir, let him be, said Sir Lucan, for he is unhappy. And if ye pass this unhappy day, ye shall be right well revenged upon him. Good Lord, remember ye of your night's dream, and what the spirit of Sir Gawain told you this night. Yet God of his great goodness hath preserved you hitherto. Therefore, for God's sake, my lord, leave off by this. For blessed be God, ye have won the field. For here we be three on live, and with Sir Mordred is none on live. And if ye leave off now, this wicked day of destiny is past. Tide me death, betide me life, saith the king. Now I see him yonder alone. He shall never escape mine hands, for at a better avail shall I never have him. God speed you well, said Sir Bedivere. Then the king gat his spear in both his hands, and ran toward Sir Mordred, crying, Traitor, now is thy death day come. And when Sir Mordred heard Sir Arthur, he ran until him, with his sword drawn in his hand. And then King Arthur smote Sir Mordred under the shield, with a foin of his spear throughout the body more than a fathom. And when Sir Mordred felt that he had his death wound, he thrust himself, with the might that he had, up to the butt of King Arthur's spear. And right so he smote his father Arthur with his sword, holden in both his hands, on the side of the head, that the sword pierced the helmet and the brain pan, and therewithal Sir Mordred fell stark dead to the earth. And the noble Arthur fell in a swoon to the earth, and there he swooned oft times.
That is a good piece of war correspondence, Clarence. You are a first-rate newspaper man. Well, is the king all right? Did he get well?
Poor soul, no, he is dead.
I was utterly stunned. It had not seemed to me that any wound could be mortal to him.
And the queen, Clarence?
She is a nun in Almesbury.
What changes, and in such a short while? It is inconceivable.
What next, I wonder?
I can tell you what next.
Well,
stake our lives and stand by them.
What do you mean by that?
The church is master now. The interdict included you with Mordred. It is not to be removed while you remain alive. The clans are gathering. The church has gathered all the knights that are left alive, and as soon as you are discovered, we shall have business on our hands.
Stuff! With our deadly scientific war material, with our hosts of trained...
Save your breath. We haven't 60 faithful left.
What are you saying? Our schools, our colleges, our vast workshops, our...
When those knights come, those establishments will empty themselves and go over to the enemy.
Did you think you had educated the superstition out of those people?
I certainly did think it.
Well, then you may unthink it.
They stood every strain easily until the interdict. Since then they merely put on a bold outside. At heart they are quaking. Make up your mind to it. When the armies come, the mask will fall.
It's hard news.
We are lost. They will turn our own science against us.
No, they won't.
Why?
Because I and a handful of the faithful have blocked that game. I'll tell you what I've done and what moved me to do it. Smart as you are, the church was smarter. It was the church that sent you cruising through her servants, the doctors.
Clarence, it is the truth, I know it. Every officer of your ship was the church's picked servant, and so was every man of the crew.
Oh, come!
It is just as I tell you. I did not find out these things at once, but I found them out, finally. Did you send me verbal information by the commander of the ship, to the effect that upon his return to you with supplies, you were going to leave Cadiz?
Cadiz? I haven't been at Cadiz at all.
Going to leave Cadiz and cruise in distant seas indefinitely. For the health of your family, did you send me that word?
Of course not. I would have written, wouldn't I?
Naturally. I was troubled and suspicious. When the commander sailed again, I managed to ship a spy with him. I have never heard of vessel or spy since. I gave myself 2 weeks to hear from you in. Then I resolved to send a ship to Cadiz. There was a reason why I didn't.
What was that?
Our navy had suddenly and mysteriously disappeared.
Also, as suddenly and as mysteriously, the railway and telegraph and telephone service ceased. The men all deserted, poles were cut down, the church laid a ban upon the electric light. I had to be up and doing and straight off. Your life was safe. Nobody in these kingdoms but Merlin would venture to touch such a magician as you without 10,000 men at his back. I had nothing to think of but how to put preparations in the best trim against your coming. I felt safe myself. Nobody would be anxious to touch a pet of yours. So this is what I did. From our various works, I selected all the men, boys, I mean, whose faithfulness under whatsoever pressure I could swear to, and I called them together secretly and gave them their instructions. There are 52 of them, none younger than 14 and none above 17 years old.
Why did you select boys?
Because all the others were born in an atmosphere of superstition and reared in it. It is in their blood and bones. We imagined we had educated it out of them. They thought so, too. The interdict woke them up like a thunderclap. It revealed them to themselves, and it revealed them to me, too. With boys, it was different. Such as have been under our training, from 7 to 10 years, have had no acquaintance with the church's terrors, and it was among these that I found my 52. As a next move, I paid a private visit to that old cave of Merlin's, not the small one, the big one.
Yes, the one where we secretly established our first great electric plant when I was projecting a miracle.
Just so. And as that miracle hadn't become necessary then, I thought it might be a good idea to utilize the plant now. I've provisioned the cave for a siege.
A good idea. A first-rate idea.
I think so. I placed 4 of my boys there as a guard, inside and out of sight.
Nobody was to be hurt while outside. But any attempt to enter, well, we said just let anybody try it. Then I went out into the hills and uncovered and cut the secret wires which connected your bedroom with the wires that go to the dynamite deposits under all our vast factories, mills, workshops, magazines, etc. And about midnight, I and my boys turned out and connected that wire with the cave. And nobody but you and I suspects where the other end of it goes to. We laid it underground, of course, and it was all finished in a couple of hours or so. We shan't have to leave our fortress now when we want to blow up our civilization. It was the right move, and the natural one. Military necessity in the changed condition of things.
Well, what changes have come?
We expected to be besieged in the palace sometime or other, but... However, go on.
Next, we built a wire fence.
Wire fence?
Yes, you dropped the hint of it yourself 2 or 3 years ago.
Oh, I remember, the time the church tried her strength against us the first time, and presently thought it wise to wait for a hopefuller season.
Well, how have you arranged the fence?
I start 12 immensely strong wires, naked, not insulated, from a big dynamo in the cave. Dynamo with no brushes except a positive and a negative one. Yes, that's right. The wires go out from the cave and fence in a circle of level ground 100 yards in diameter. They make 12 independent fences 10 feet apart. That is to say, 12 circles within circles, and their ends come into the cave again. Right, go on. The fences are fastened to heavy oaken posts, only 3 feet apart, and these posts are sunk 5 feet in the ground. That is good and strong. Yes, the wires have no ground connection outside of the cave. They go out from the positive brush of the dynamo. There is a ground connection through the negative brush. The other ends of the wire return to the cave, and each is grounded independently. No, no, that won't do. Why? It's too expensive. Uses up force for nothing. You don't want any ground connection except the one through the negative brush. The other end of every wire must be brought back into the cave and fastened independently, and without any ground connection. Now then, observe the economy of it. A cavalry charge hurls itself against the fence. You are using no power, you're spending no money, for there is only one ground connection till those horses come against the wire. The moment they touch it, they form a connection with the negative brush through the ground and drop dead. Don't you see? You are using no energy until it is needed. Your lightning is there and ready like the load in a gun, but it isn't costing you a cent till you touch it off. Oh, yes, the single ground connection. Of course, I don't know how I overlooked that. It's not only cheaper, but it's more effectual than the other way, for if wires break or get tangled, no harm is done. No, especially if we have a telltale in the cave and disconnect the broken wire. Well, go on, the Gatlings? Yes, that's arranged. In the center of the inner circle, on a spacious platform 6 feet high, I've grouped a battery of 13 Gatling guns and provided plenty of ammunition. That's it. They command every approach, and when the church's knights arrive, there's gonna be music. The brow of the precipice over the cave, I've got a wire fence there and a Gatling. They won't drop any rocks down on us. Well, and the glass cylinder dynamite torpedoes? That's attended to. It's the prettiest garden that was ever planted. It's a belt 40 feet wide and goes around the outer fence. Distance between it and the fence 100 yards. Kind of neutral ground, that space is. There isn't a single square yard of that whole belt but is equipped with a torpedo. We laid them on the surface of the ground and sprinkled a layer of sand over them. It's an innocent-looking garden, but you let a man start in to hoe it once, and you'll see. You tested the torpedoes? Well, I was going to, but... But what? Why, it's an immense oversight not to apply a... Test? Yes, I know, but they're all right. I laid a few in the public road beyond our lines, and they've been tested. Oh, that alters the case. Who did it? A church committee. How kind. Yes, they came to command us to make submission. You see, they didn't really come to test the torpedoes. That was merely an incident. Did the committee make a report? Yes, they made one. You could have heard it a mile. Unanimous? That was the nature of it. After that, I put up some signs for the protection of future committees, and we have had no intruders since. Clarence, you've done a world of work and done it perfectly. We've had plenty of time for it. There wasn't any occasion for hurry. We sat silent a while, thinking. Then my mind was made up, and I said, "Yes, everything is ready. Everything is ship-shape. No detail is wanting. I know what to do now."
"So do I. Sit down and wait."
"No, sir. Rise up and strike."
"Do you mean it?"
"Yes, indeed. The defensive isn't in my line, and the offensive is. That is, when I hold a fair hand, two-thirds as good a hand as the enemy. Oh, yes, we'll rise up and strike. That's our game.
100-1, you are right. When does the performance begin?
Now. We'll proclaim the Republic.
Well, that will precipitate things, sure enough.
It will make them buzz, I tell you.
England will be a hornet's nest before noon tomorrow if the church's hand hasn't lost its cunning, and we know it hasn't. Now, you write, and I'll dictate thus.
Proclamation. Be it known unto all. Whereas the king, having died and left no heir, it becomes my duty to continue the executive authority vested in me, until a government shall have been created and set in motion. The monarchy has lapsed. It no longer exists. By consequence, all political power has reverted to its original source, the people of the nation. With the monarchy, its several adjuncts died also. Wherefore, there is no longer a nobility, no longer a privileged class, no longer an established church. All men are become exactly equal. They are upon one common level, and religion is free. A republic is hereby proclaimed as being the natural estate of a nation when other authority has ceased. It is the duty of the British people to meet together immediately and by their votes elect representatives and deliver into their hands the government. I signed it, The Boss, and dated it from Merlin's Cave.
Clarence said, "Why, that tells where we are and invites them to call right away."
That is the idea. We strike by the proclamation. Then it's their innings. Now have the thing set up and printed and posted right off. That is, give the order. Then if you've got a couple bicycles handy at the foot of the hill, ho for Merlin's Cave.
I shall be ready in 10 minutes.
What a cyclone there is going to be tomorrow when this piece of paper gets to work. It's a pleasant old palace, this is. I wonder if we shall ever again... But never mind about that.
Chapter 43. The Battle of the Sand Belt. In Merlin's Cave, Clarence and I and 52 fresh, bright, well-educated, clean-minded young British boys. At dawn, I sent an order to the factories and to all our great works to stop operations and remove all life to a safe distance, as everything was going to be blown up by secret mines, and no telling at what moment. Therefore, vacate at once. These people knew me and had confidence in my word. They would clear out without waiting to part their hair, and I could take my own time about dating the explosion. You couldn't hire one of them to go back during the century if the explosion was still impending. We had a week of waiting. It was not dull for me because I was writing all the time. During the first 3 days, I finished turning my old diary into this narrative form. It only required a chapter or so to bring it down to date. The rest of the week, I took up in writing letters to my wife. It was always my habit to write to Sandy every day, whenever we were separate, and now I kept up the habit for love of it, and of her, though I couldn't do anything with the letters, of course, after I had written them. But it put in the time, you see, and was almost like talking. It was almost as if I was saying, "Sandy, if you and Hello Central were here in the cave instead of only your photographs, what good times we could have." And then, you know, I could imagine the baby goo-gooing something out in reply, with its fists in its mouth, and itself stretched across its mother's lap on its back, and she a-laughing and admiring and worshipping, and now and then tickling under the baby's chin to set it cackling, and then maybe throwing in a word of answer to me herself, and so on and so on. Well, don't you know, I could sit there in the cave with my pen and keep it up that way by the hour with them. Why, it was almost like having us all together again. I had spies out every night, of course, to get news. Every report made things look more and more impressive. The hosts were gathering, gathering. Down all the roads and paths of England, the knights were riding, and priests rode with them, to hearten these original crusaders, this being the church's war. All the nobilities, big and little, were on their way, and all the gentry. This was all as was expected. We should thin out this sort of folk to such a degree that the people would have nothing to do but just step to the front with their republic and... Oh, what a donkey I was. Toward the end of the week, I began to get this large and disenchanting fact through my head, that the mass of the nation had swung their caps and shouted for the republic for about one day and there an end. The church, the nobles, and the gentry then turned one grand, all-disapproving frown upon them and shriveled them into sheep. From that moment, the sheep had begun to gather to the fold, that is to say the camps, and offer their valueless lives and their valuable wool to the righteous cause. Why, even the very men who had lately been slaves were in the righteous cause, and glorifying it, praying for it, sentimentally slabbering over it, just like all the other commoners. Imagine such human muck as this. Conceive of this folly. Yes, it was now death to the Republic everywhere. Not a dissenting voice. All England was marching against us. Truly, this was more than I had bargained for. I watched my 52 boys narrowly. Watched their faces, their walk, their unconscious attitudes, for all these are a language. A language given us purposely that it may betray us in times of emergency, when we have secrets which we want to keep. I knew that that thought would keep saying itself over and over again in their minds and hearts. All England is marching against us, and ever more strenuously imploring attention with each repetition, ever more sharply realizing itself to their imaginations, until even in their sleep they would find no rest from it, but hear the vague and flitting creatures of the dream say, "All England, all England is marching against you." I knew all this would happen. I knew that ultimately the pressure would become so great that it would compel utterance. Therefore, I must be ready with an answer at that time, an answer well chosen and tranquilizing. I was right. The time came. They had to speak. Poor lads, it was pitiful to see. They were so pale, so worn, so troubled. At first, their spokesman could hardly find voice or words, but he presently got both. This is what he said. And he put it in the neat modern English taught him in my schools.
"We have tried to forget what we are, English boys. We have tried to put reason before sentiment, duty before love. Our minds approve, but our hearts reproach us. While apparently it was only the nobility, only the gentry, only the 25 or 30,000 knights left alive out of the late wars, we were of one mind, and undisturbed by any troubling doubt. Each and every one of these 52 lads who stand here before you said, they have chosen, it is their affair. But think, the matter is altered. All England is marching against us. Oh, sir, consider, reflect. These people are our people. They are bone of our bone, flesh of our flesh. We love them. Do not ask us to destroy our nation."
Well, it shows the value of looking ahead and being ready for a thing when it happens. If I hadn't foreseen this thing and been fixed, that boy would have had me. I couldn't have said a word. But I was fixed. I said, "My boys, your hearts are in the right place. You have thought the worthy thought. You have done the worthy thing.
You are English boys. You will remain English boys, and you will keep that name unsmirched. Give yourselves no further concern. Let your minds be at peace. Consider this. While all England is marching against us, who is in the van? Who, by the commonest rules of war, will march in the front? Answer me.
The mounted host of mailed knights.
True. They are 30,000 strong. Acres deep they will march. Now observe, none but they will ever strike the sand belt. Then there will be an episode. Immediately after, the civilian multitude in the rear will retire to meet business engagements elsewhere. None but nobles and gentry are knights, and none but these will remain to dance to our music after that episode. It is absolutely true that we shall have to fight nobody but these 30,000 knights. Now speak, and it shall be as you decide. Shall we avoid the battle? Retire from the field?
No!
The shout was unanimous and hearty. Are you, afraid of these 30,000 knights? That joke brought out a good laugh. The boys' troubles vanished away, and they went gaily to their posts. Ah, they were a darling 52. As pretty as girls, too. I was ready for the enemy now. Let the approaching big day come along, it would find us on deck. The big day arrived on time. At dawn, the sentry on watch in the corral came into the cave and reported a moving black mass under the horizon, and a faint sound which he thought to be military music. Breakfast was just ready. We sat down and ate it. This over, I made the boys a little speech, and then sent out a detail to man the battery with Clarence in command of it. The sun rose presently and sent its unobstructed splendors over the land, and we saw a prodigious host moving slowly toward us, with the steady drift and aligned front of a wave of the sea. Nearer and nearer it came, and more sublimely imposing became its aspect. Yes, all England was there, apparently. Soon we could see the innumerable banners fluttering, and then the sun struck the sea of armor and set it all aflash. Yes, it was a fine sight. I hadn't ever seen anything to beat it. At last we could make out details. All the front ranks, no telling how many acres deep, were horsemen, plumed knights in armor. Suddenly we heard the blare of trumpets. The slow walk burst into a gallop, and then, well, it was wonderful to see. Down swept that vast horseshoe wave. It approached the sand belt. My breath stood still. Nearer, nearer. The strip of green turf beyond the yellow belt grew narrow, narrower still, became a mere ribbon in front of the horses, then disappeared under their hoofs. Great Scott! While the whole front of that host shot into the sky with a thunder crash and became a whirling tempest of rags and fragments, and along the ground lay a thick wall of smoke that hid what was left of the multitude from our sight. Time for the second step in the plan of campaign. I touched a button and shook the bones of England loose from her spine. In that explosion, all our noble civilization factories went up in the air and disappeared from the earth. It was a pity, but it was necessary. We could not afford to let the enemy turn our own weapons against us. Now ensued one of the dullest quarter hours I had ever endured. We waited in a silent solitude enclosed by our circles of wire, and by a circle of heavy smoke outside of these. We couldn't see over the wall of smoke, and we couldn't see through it. But at last it began to shred away lazily, and by the end of another quarter hour the land was clear, and our curiosity was enabled to satisfy itself. No living creature was in sight.
We now perceived that additions had been made to our defenses. The dynamite had dug a ditch more than 100 feet wide all around us and cast up an embankment some 25 feet high on both borders of it. As to destruction of life, it was amazing. Moreover, it was beyond estimate. Of course, we could not count the dead because they did not exist as individuals, but merely as homogeneous protoplasm with alloys of iron and buttons. No life was in sight, but necessarily there must have been some wounded in the rear ranks who were carried off the field under cover of the wall of smoke. There would be sickness among the others, there always is after an episode like that, but there would be no reinforcements. This was the last stand of the chivalry of England. It was all that was left of the order after the recent annihilating wars. So I felt quite safe in believing that the utmost force that could for the future be brought against us would be but small, that is, of knights. I therefore issued a congratulatory proclamation to my army in these words: "Soldiers, champions of human liberty and equality, your general congratulates you. In the pride of his strength and the vanity of his renown, an arrogant enemy came against you. You were ready. The conflict was brief, on your side glorious. This mighty victory, having been achieved utterly without loss, stands without example in history. So long as the planets shall continue to move in their orbits, the Battle of the Sand Belt will not perish out of the memories of men. The Boss." I read it well, and the applause I got was very gratifying to me. I then wound up with these remarks: "The war with the English nation, as a nation, is at an end. The nation has retired from the field and the war. Before it can be persuaded to return, war will have ceased. This campaign is the only one that is going to be fought. It will be brief, the briefest in history, also the most destructive to life, considered from the standpoint of proportion of casualties to numbers engaged. We are done with the nation. Henceforth, we deal only with the knights. English knights can be killed, but they cannot be conquered. We know what is before us. While one of these men remains alive, our task is not finished. The war is not ended. We will kill them all." Loud and long continued applause. I picketed the great embankments thrown up around our lines by the dynamite explosion, merely a lookout of a couple of boys to announce the enemy when he should appear again. Next, I sent an engineer and 40 men to a point just beyond our lines on the south, to turn a mountain brook that was there and bring it within our lines and under our command, arranging it in such a way that I could make instant use of it in an emergency. The 40 men were divided into 2 shifts of 20 each and were to relieve each other every 2 hours. In 10 hours, the work was accomplished. It was nightfall now, and I withdrew my pickets. The one who had had the northern outlook reported a camp in sight, but visible with the glass only. He also reported that a few knights had been feeling their way toward us and had driven some cattle across our lines, but that the knights themselves had not come very near. That was what I had been expecting. They were feeling us, you see. They wanted to know if we were going to play that red terror on them again. They would grow bolder in the night, perhaps. I believed I knew what project they would attempt, because it was plainly the thing I would attempt myself, if I were in their places and as ignorant as they were. I mentioned it to Clarence. "I think you are right," said he. "It is the obvious thing for them to try." "Well, then," I said, "if they do it, they are doomed." "Certainly. They won't have the slightest show in the world." "Of course they won't." "It's dreadful, Clarence. It seems an awful pity." The thing disturbed me so that I couldn't get any peace of mind for thinking of it and worrying over it. So at last, to quiet my conscience, I framed this message to the knights. To the Honorable, the Commander of the Insurgent Chivalry of England, you fight in vain.